Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear the 2015 Ross Horning Lecture, presented annually by the Creighton Department of History in commemoration of Dr. Ross Horning, a professor of history at Creighton University from 1964 until his death in 2005. The lecture is meant to reflect the many dimensions of his life, including his love for history, the arts, and the community. This year's speaker will be Margaret McMillan, the warden of St. Anthony's College and a professor of international history at the University of Oxford, author of several books, including Women of the Raj, The Mothers, Wives, and Daughters of the British Empire in India, The Uses and Abuses of History, and most recently, The War That Ended Peace, The Path to 1914, and a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and a senior fellow of Massey College, the University of Toronto, honorary fellow of Trinity College, the University of Toronto, and of St. Hilda's College, the University of Oxford. The topic of her lecture will be, Was World War I Inevitable? This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 9, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is John Calvert, chairman of the Department of History at Creighton University.
Last year in the History Department, we sat down to deliberate about who to invite to speak at this year's Horning Lecture. We knew we wanted to recognize the centenary of the Great War. Professor McMillan's name was the first to be mentioned, and there the discussion ended. We could think of no one more qualified. A native of Toronto, Margaret McMillan is professor of international history and warden of St. Anthony's College at Oxford University. Her research focuses on the British Empire in the late 19th and early 20th centuries and on international relations in the 20th century. Her publications and honors are impressive and far too numerous to list here fully, and so a few brief highlights will have to suffice. She's an officer of the Order of Canada. She sits on the boards and institutes and foundations and is the recipient of several honorary degrees. Among the 10 books she has written are Nixon in China, the award-winning Paris 1919, 6 months that changed the world, and her most recent book, The War That Ended Peace, The Road to 1914, which has received great praise in the review literature. Authoritative, engaging, richly textured. These are some of the words that have been employed to describe it. We're so pleased that Professor McMillan can join us on this cool and drizzly Omaha evening. There will be a brief question and answer session following the lecture, and Professor McMillan will be available to sign books after the event. The men and women who served in the Great War are now all gone. But 100 years onward, debate over the origins of the cataclysm is as keen as ever. Tonight, Margaret McMillan will address the big question, was World War I inevitable? Please join me in welcoming Margaret McMillan.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Professor Calvert, for that very nice introduction. I think even my mother would have approved. And thank you to the History Department for inviting me to give this annual lecture. I was reading about Ross Horning in the handout before the lecture, and I thought, what an extraordinary person with so many different aspects to his life and so many different qualities. So it's a great honor to be giving a lecture that is named after him. And it's a great pleasure to be here in Omaha. First visit ever, and I'm sorry I'm not going to be able to see more of it, because even the very short time I've had here makes me realize what a lovely and warm city it is. Well, warm in the sense of hospitality. We won't go into the rest of it. 100 years ago, or 101 years ago now, in the summer of 1914, Sir Ernest Shackleton, the great Antarctic explorer, was about to set sail for an expedition to the Antarctic, as the war was about to break out in Europe. And he asked his friend Winston Churchill, who was at that point in charge of the British Navy, should he go? And Churchill said, by all means go, don't worry. And so Shackleton went off and went to South Georgia Island, which is the last sort of point of contact with the outside world, and from there jumped off into the Antarctic, where he had a very difficult expedition. He was there through the winter of 1914, 1915. He eventually managed to get himself and his men back to South Georgia Island after a harrowing trip. And when he arrived back, and this was his first contact with the outside world since the summer of 1914, he said, the first question he asked was, who won the war in Europe? And they said, no, it's still going on. And he said, you must be joking, you can't mean it. And they said, yes, the war is still going on. And he said, I don't know what's happened, they must have all gone mad. And that, I think, was a feeling that a lot of people around the world had, and a lot of Europeans themselves had. How could they have got themselves into a war, a dreadful war, largely of stalemate, where both sides were strong enough to resist attacks from the other side, but neither side was strong enough to win? A war that, in the summer of 1914, people like Shackleton thought would be over in 6 weeks, be over before the winter rains came, was going to go on for over 4 years. And it was going to destroy much of the old Europe and leave a very different world. And I think that's one of the reasons why the First World War still haunts us and why we still think so much about it. I think we look back at the period before 1914, perhaps especially in Europe, but in the world in general, and we think it was a period where there really was some hope for the future. There was hope that the world was becoming a more peaceful place. There was hope that progress, the very evident progress of the 19th century, again, perhaps particularly in Europe, was going to continue, and hope that prosperity was going to increase around the world and, of course, in Europe as well. When people look back at that period before 1914, they look at a different age, an age which has vanished. And I think one of the questions we all ask is, how could Europe have done it? How could they have taken what were tremendous advantages, tremendous progress, tremendous prosperity, and thrown it away in this dreadful conflict, something that Europe has never really recovered from? And if we think of what Europe was like in the years before 1914, it was extraordinarily successful. In European terms, Europe has never been a very peaceful part of the world, but in European terms, the century from 1815, when the Napoleonic Wars ended, to the outbreak of the First World War, was the most peaceful century that Europe had known in perhaps two millennia. It had had wars, but those wars had generally been short and generally between two countries and generally had settled something. And so the German Confederation had fought Austria-Hungary. That war was over within 6 weeks, and it resulted in Austria-Hungary and Germany coming to peace terms. The German Confederation and France had fought in 1870, and that war again had been over. At least the military part of it was over in 6 weeks, and again, there was going to be a decisive outcome. And so Europeans had begun to think by the end of that long period that war was not something that their nations did anymore, that they weren't fighting much anymore, that the wars they'd had seemed to be pretty much in the past, that perhaps war was something that Europeans never were going to do again, that they had moved beyond it, that they had become a more peaceful continent, they were finding other ways of settling their disputes. As they look back at that long century from 1815 to 1914, and it felt long because it really brought such changes, they could also see extraordinary changes in Europe. Europe had gone from being primarily agricultural in 1815 to becoming a major industrial powerhouse of the world. Europe was collectively, the European nations were the most prosperous part of the world by the end of the 19th century. They had the most advanced science, the most advanced technology, the factories. Their factories produced the most of any factories in the world. European countries dominated the world's trade. Europe was where you went if you wanted to borrow money to build infrastructure. Europe was where you went if you wanted new ideas, whether these were ideas of government. The American president at the time of the First World War, Woodrow Wilson, as a university professor, had looked at Europe as providing examples of how to do good government. And so Europe was in its own eyes, and I think in the eyes of many around the world, not just the most powerful part of the world before 1914, but also, in fact, the leading part of the world. And again, I think it makes the question of why did Europe do it? Why did it throw it all away? All the more pressing. And we're all, I think, aware of what that war did, not just to Europe, but to the world. I think we have, all of us, a sense of the destruction of that war. 9 million men died in that war. It was a war in which those who died were mostly those who were doing the fighting. The hideous civilian casualties of earlier wars and, of course, of the Second World War were not there in the First World War. It was the men, by and large, who died, although in some countries women died as well, and certainly women and children were going to die of starvation as a result of the war and of disease as a result of the war. 9 million men, I mean, it's a huge amount. Very, very difficult to even imagine what that meant for the societies. The French lost 1.4 million men, and I think it is something the French have never really recovered from. The British and the British Empire lost over 800,000 men. You've probably all seen descriptions of the battle, such as the first day of the Battle of the Somme. 50,000 people dying in one day. It's the size of a fair-sized town. The casualties were absolutely huge. And, of course, there were also those who were wounded, both psychologically and physically, by the war, many of whom were never going to recover. Probably twice as many men were wounded and damaged by the First World War. And that, again, was a toll that Europe was going to have to bear. The map of Europe changed as a result of the war. Old societies were shaken, old empires were shaken, in some cases to the point of revolution or disappearance. In Russia, there was a revolution in 1917, which brought, ultimately, a very small splinter group called the Bolsheviks to power. I remember going once to a talk in Oxford by someone who'd been a 10-year-old in St. Petersburg in 1917 when the Bolsheviks seized power in that autumn. And he was part of a family that were very interested in politics. His uncles and aunts were always coming in and bringing the latest political gossip. And one of them came home one day and said, a group called the Bolsheviks have taken over the government. And he said, the 10-year-old, he said, well, who are they? And they said, oh, don't worry, they'll be gone in a week. Well, they became the Russian Communist Party, and they weren't gone in a week. And the consequences of that style of communism, of course, were going to have huge impact, was going to have a huge impact on the 20th century. Austria-Hungary, that huge multinational empire at the center of Europe, which had kept, in its own way, peace among many different religions and ethnicities, was shaken to pieces by the First World War and disappeared in the last months of that war, leaving behind a whole host of ethnically based states, a Czechoslovakian state, a Yugoslav state, Poland reemerging, Romania, Hungary, Austria, and this was going to cause endless trouble in the future because these states fell to quarreling with each other almost as soon as they appeared on the map. The Ottoman Empire, which controlled parts of Europe, Turkey, and pretty much the whole of the Arab Middle East, was going to disappear in the weeks and months immediately after the First World War. And it was going to be carved up, its Arab territories were going to be carved up by the British and the French, with consequences which we're still seeing today. As you probably know, if you follow the increasingly depressing news from the Middle East, there is more and more talk about how the borders drawn in the aftermath of the First World War are now going to be changed. And so the First World War really did, quite literally, and in many other ways, change the map of Europe and change the map of much of the rest of the world. It also, of course, changed the position of Europe in the world. Europe spent its wealth, as well as the lives of its men, in the First World War, and it was never going to be as powerful and as prosperous again. That was also going to speed up the disappearance of the great European empires. Before the First World War, European countries collectively had controlled much of the rest of the world, either directly, in the case of Africa, large parts of Asia, parts of North America, or indirectly, through their investments, through their financial power, through their trade, through their military power. Europe was going to see its empires disappear, and the disappearance of those empires was hastened by the First World War. The First World War not only weakened the European countries themselves, but what it did is shake and ultimately destroy the faith that many people in the empires had that Europeans actually were fitted to rule over them. The young men who came from India or from Morocco or from Algeria or from parts of Africa to fight in the European war in Europe no longer had any confidence that European civilization was in any way superior to their own. In fact, many of those young men went back and became involved in nationalist movements in their own countries. What you also saw, of course, as a result of the First World War, was the rise of new powers. Now, this would probably have happened, but it was speeded up, I think, very much by the war. Japan became, even more than it had been before the First World War, a great Asian power. And, of course, the rise of the United States to world dominance was hastened very much by the First World War. So it was a war that in many ways and at many different levels affected not just the societies that fought in it, but affected the world as a whole. And perhaps what still haunts us also about that war is it didn't really seem to settle anything. It didn't leave a more peaceful world behind. In fact, it left behind the conditions that made the Second World War possible. And so I think even more, at least in my view, than the Second World War, the First World War seems to us, or seems to me, really the seminal event of the 20th century and one which still casts a shadow over us, which is one of the reasons why we continue to argue about how it started. And we think that we have to find out how it started because a catastrophe on that scale has to be explained. We have been trying, collectively, historians, the rest of us, have been trying to explain how that war started almost from the moment the first shots were fired. In 1914, as the war broke out, different governments and different historians hastened to write books, publish documents, arguing that it wasn't their fault, of course, it was the fault of the other side. And that debate has gone on ever since. It has had really important political consequences. At the end of the First World War, it was really important for the victorious Allies to show that Germany had started the war in order that they could demand that Germany pay reparations. And it was very important for Germany to show that it hadn't started the war so that it would undermine the argument that it needed to pay reparations. And that has, so that the debate is not just one among historians, it's one that's had very real and practical consequences. It's been estimated that in English there are something like 30,000 pieces of work written on the origins of the First World War. I have not, I must confess, read them all. But you probably all had the experience of going into a library or going into a bookstore and just looking for books on the origins of the First World War. And you will see shelf after shelf after shelf. Look for the same thing on the Second World War, and the shelves will be much shorter. We're much clearer, I think, and there's much more consensus about how the Second World War started than there is about how the First World War started. The explanations have ranged over a whole set of possible causes for the First World War. And there's something to be said for each one of them. Was it the different alliance systems that began to develop in Europe before 1914, where you had on the one hand Germany, Austria, Hungary, and Italy forming a grouping, and on the other hand you had France, Russia, and Britain forming a grouping? Did those alliance systems add to tension? Did they mean that if two countries got into a conflict, the other partners of the alliances would have to come in? And there's been a great deal of debate on that. My own view is it's not entirely the fault of the alliance systems, but clearly they played a part. Was it the responsibility of one country? Was it the fault of Germany, which was for a long time an argument made in the English-speaking world? Did Germany, and in particular did the German leadership, Kaiser Wilhelm II, the German ruler, the German high command, the German government, did they want a war in order to destroy their neighbors, France and Russia, or at least to keep them under control? Were they trying to dominate Europe? Was that really what lay behind the war? And of course, that argument has been very much influenced by the Second World War, where in fact you could argue that the German leader, Adolf Hitler, wanted to do precisely that. Or was it the fault of France, which had suffered a defeat at the hands of Germany in 1870, had lost two provinces as a result, had had to pay a large indemnity, a large fine to Germany? Was it the fault of France that was bent on revenge, and did that help to create the First World War? Was it the fault of Russia, which was arming very fast and developing very fast before the First World War? Was it the fault of Russia for forming an alliance with Germany, with France rather, that made Germany feel encircled? The Germans shared a border with Russia in those days, and they shared, of course, a border with France, and when France and Russia drew closer together, did the Germans rightly think that they were being menaced by this growing alliance? Was it the fault of Great Britain for not making itself clearer about what it would do if a war broke out? Should the British have said very openly to the Germans, don't think of fighting France because we will come in? About the only country so far that hasn't been blamed is my own country, Canada. But I'm working on it. Was it economic forces? Was it the economic rivalries? Was it competition for markets between different countries? Was it competition for colonies? There were times when European countries very nearly came to war over grabbing colonies in different parts of the world. Britain and France nearly came to war in 1898. Britain and Russia had some very difficult moments where they might have come to war. And so did that rivalry, that attempt to grab colonies around the world, help to stir up the tensions in Europe? Or was it the fault of ideas? Was it the fault of militarism, the idea that military values are the best that a society could have, that the military in some way represent the best part of society? Was it the fault of the arms race that was taking place before 1914? Was it the fault of ideas of honor, where countries felt they couldn't back down because in some sense they would be dishonored? Or was it, as others have suggested, including the wartime British Prime Minister David Lloyd George, was it nobody's fault? Was it simply one of those things that happened? As Lloyd George said in his memoirs later on, European countries slithered over the edge into the cauldron of war without really giving heed to what they were doing. And so the arguments go on, because it is very, very difficult to pick out one sort of explanation. My own explanation, if you want me to give it to you in a nutshell, is that there is not one cause and not one factor and not one person and not one country. I think it was, if I can think of an analogy, what I think happened in 1914 was something like what happened to me today in O'Hare Airport in Chicago, and it was a perfect storm. When I flew into O'Hare today, there was a thunderstorm which made complete chaos of everything that was happening in the airport. Well, what happened in the summer of 1914 was, in a way, a perfect storm. A number of things happened in a particular order at a particular time with particular people involved. It needn't have happened that way, and I'll come back to that. I think there was a role of accident. But I think what had happened by 1914 was that Europe had got itself into a position, or key people in Europe, and that's important, had got themselves into a position where they thought war was in some way a solution, that war was a way out of their problems, war was going to settle things, war would in fact clear the air. A very common metaphor which was being used in Europe before 1914 was that we're living through a thunderstorm, or the period before a thunderstorm, when it's very hot, it's sultry, you almost want the storm to come so that the air will be cleared. You know a storm is coming, you just want to get it over. And there were a lot of people, unfortunately, in positions of decision-making in Europe in 1914, who were saying, there is a storm here, there's a threatening storm, let's just get it over with, and then we can just go on as usual. But let me look at some of the factors, I think, which were predisposing Europeans to think in this way. But before I do that, what I'd like to do is just remind us all that it wasn't foreordained that Europe was going to go down that road. I don't think the war was inevitable. I think there is a real danger in looking backwards, which is, of course, what we do in history, and seeing all the reasons why the war might have broken out, and then jumping from that to saying, yes, of course, it had to happen. There's so many reasons there that logically the war was bound to happen. Now, I don't think it was logically or inevitably bound to happen. I think, yes, there were all sorts of reasons why a war might have happened. But you can say the same thing about our own times. You can say this, you could have said the same thing about the Cold War. If you looked at the tensions in the Cold War, you would have, I think, concluded that it was almost inevitable that there was going to be a major conflict between the two sides. I don't think we should make that mistake. I think we should look back and recognize my view that Europe did in fact have choices, that it was possible that it could have gone in a different direction. Like all societies, including our own, there were different currents in Europe. Not everyone in Europe was thinking the same way. There were debates, often very passionate debates, about what European countries should be doing, what policies countries should follow, and how Europe should manage its affairs internationally. And so although, yes, we can find and we can identify forces in Europe that predisposed certain people to think that war might be a necessary or a good thing. There were also a lot of people in Europe who thought war was not something that they wanted or even was probable. That long period of prosperity and progress and of relative peace in Europe had convinced many Europeans that war was simply unthinkable. It was not something that was going to happen. They had moved beyond that. And you get quite a few Europeans saying, you know, when we were less civilized, we might have fought wars, but we have now become more civilized. We don't need to do it. And a lot of Europeans pointed to things such as the growing participation by the public. This was an age in which more and more people were becoming literate, more and more people learning to read and write, mass newspapers, more and more people taking an interest in international affairs. And what a lot of optimists thought was that the more the public participates, the more peaceful Europe is likely to become. Now, that, as it turns out, is not always going to be the case, but I think there was a feeling that the better educated the public, the more people understand that it's not in their interest to have a war, the less likely there is to be a war. There was also a very strong argument that was made that Europe had become by 1914 so intertwined in so many different ways that a war really didn't make sense. It would be like a family conflict. And the intertwining went from family relationships. If you look at many of the rulers of Europe before 1914, they were related. Tsar Nicholas of Russia was a cousin of George V of England. George V of England was a cousin of Wilhelm II of Germany, who was also related to Nicholas II of Russia. The three ambassadors in London from Germany, Austria, Hungary, and Russia, and Russia was soon to be at war with Austria, Hungary, and Germany in London in 1914, those three ambassadors were cousins and knew each other very well. And that wasn't just at the level of royal families or the aristocracy. It was also at the level of middle-class people, because it was a lot easier to travel around Europe by now. Transportation was getting cheaper. It was the beginnings of mass tourism. And young Europeans were traveling, working in different cities, going to each other's universities. When the First World War broke out, four members of the British cabinet had been educated at German universities, and a number of Germans had been educated at British universities. So this was something that seemed to be moving Europe in the direction of becoming more and more integrated. Europe was also a lot more integrated economically, and that was true not just of Europe, but of the world in general. The period before 1914 was a great age of globalization, as great, I think, as the one that we have been living through since the end of the Cold War. And what that meant was that people were moving around the world, people were moving across Europe, settling in different countries, and of course moving out of Europe, moving to the Americas, moving to Australia, moving to Asia. Asians were moving around the world. This was a great age of movements of people. It was also a great age of rapid communications, steamships, beginnings of flight, telegraphs, railways. It was becoming possible now to communicate with the world as a whole and also to move around it. And of course, it was also an age of tremendous integration of trade, of world trade, but also trade within Europe. Britain and Germany, just to take one example, were very large trading partners with each other. And a lot of people said, well, of course Britain and Germany can't go to war. Countries that trade with each other can't possibly go to war. A very famous book was written by a British journalist called Norman Angell before the First World War, which sold widely. Universities actually had courses on it, because what he argued, it was called The Great Illusion. He said, it's a complete illusion that war pays for itself. It's a complete waste of money. You gain nothing by it. Everyone suffers. European statesmen will surely be sensible enough to recognize that there is no point anymore in going to war. It's not, he said, like the Middle Ages, where you could march and take over someone's castle and loot his gold plate or his armor and carry it away, and you actually got something out of it. If you try, and if you're Germany, you try and invade Belgium, and you take Belgium factories, you're not going to get what you would get if you just let the Belgians work away and you could buy the products of their factories. If you go and try and take their factories, they're not going to work for you. You'll destroy the factories. You'll be worse off. The whole of Europe will be worse off. And so war just doesn't make any economic sense. And I think a lot of Europeans and a lot of people around the world felt that. In addition, though, to this sort of passive view that war isn't going to happen because it's so improbable or it's just not going to pay or it's not what we do in the modern world, there were also a lot of people working very actively for peace. There was a very large middle class peace movement. which people organized to try and think of ways to promote peace. And one of the ways they pushed for, and governments often listened, was disarmament. There were two big disarmament conferences held in The Hague, one in 1897 and one in 1907, where the powers of the world, including powers from outside Europe, such as Japan and the United States, met to try and talk not about abolishing war, but ways of limiting war, ways of trying to cope with war, ways of trying to make war less dreadful. There was meant to be a third disarmament conference in 1915, but for obvious reasons, that one didn't take place. But there were also citizens' groups, church groups, groups of lawyers, international groups of lawyers, and some very prominent individuals as well, who gave a great deal of time and money to the cause of peace. Andrew Carnegie, who was a great Scottish-American billionaire, contributed huge amounts for the study of war and also the study of peace. And he also paid to have an extraordinary building, if you ever go to The Hague in the Netherlands, go and see it, called the Peace Palace, which he had built to house the permanent International Court of Arbitration. Arbitration was also something that a lot of people were working towards as they were working towards disarmament. What arbitration meant was that if nations had a dispute, say over a piece of territory or over a clash, perhaps someone had sunk someone's shipping by mistake, rather than going to war or threatening war, what they could do is agree to take their dispute to a third party, to another country. And each side would have to agree to abide by what that third country said or by what the Court of Arbitration said. And a number of nations were now prepared to do this. The British and the Americans had a dispute over a number of things, but one of the disputes they had was over the Alaska Panhandle, which the British and Americans both claimed. They agreed to take it to arbitration, and much to the fury of the Canadians, the Alaska Panhandle was awarded to the United States. It's something we've never entirely forgotten, I'm just warning you. There were some 300 of such arbitrations held between nations between 1794 and 1914, so in a period of about 120 years. More than half those 300 arbitrations were held after 1890. And so if you're a European, and if you're anyone who cares about peace before 1914, you can see a trend developing. More and more arbitrations, more and more countries agreeing to settle their disputes in this way. You also got the growth of international NGOs, such as the Red Cross, which tried, if not to prevent war, tried to mitigate the course, the prospects of war. In addition, there was a very important organization, or potentially very important organization, called the Second International. This was an organization that was set up to bring together all the left-wing parties of the world. Socialist parties, the British Labour Party, the French Socialist Party, the German Socialist Party, and so on. It had a permanent office by 1900 in Brussels. It had biennial meetings every 2 years of delegates from around the world at which they would talk about issues of common interest to the working classes. So they'd talk about things like labor conditions, hours of work, employment problems, and so on. But what they also talked about was how to prevent war. And they were very concerned that a major war might break out, which would, of course, affect their members. Because in Europe, before the First World War, Europeans had what were called conscript armies. In other words, young men of military age had to do their military service, or a certain proportion did. You went into the armed forces for 2 to 3 years, learnt to be a soldier or a sailor, and then you went back to being a civilian. You went back to whatever your job was or into your ordinary life, but you remained in the reserves, usually for 7 years. And so if a crisis came, and this was expected, the government could call you back. And so Europe had in waiting very, very large armies indeed. That's how those big armies came together in 1914. It was calling back those reserves. And what the leaders of the Second International said when they met, they said there's no reason why we should fight in a general war. It'll be our men who'll be the cannon fodder by and large. They'll have to go and fight. Why should they? Who's going to make the money out of the war? It's going to be the people who own the factories, who make the weapons. It's going to be the heads of the countries who benefit from it. It's not going to be our members. And so what we should do is say we don't want to take part. And so there was really serious talk before 1914 of calling a general strike if there was something like a general war about to come. And what that would have meant And there was, right up to the final days in 1914, they were talking about this. If they had called a general strike, the soldiers, the reserves would have refused to come back. So those armies could not have been as big as they were. They would have been chaotic. The French military were actually so convinced that this was a prospect, they were so worried about it, they estimated that 20% of the men called back wouldn't come. Very high proportion indeed. In the event that didn't happen, almost everyone came back, but they weren't to know it. If there had been a general strike, not only would there have not been the giant armies forming, but the factories wouldn't have worked, the trains wouldn't have worked, the coal mines wouldn't have worked, and coal was the primary fuel of Europe in these days. Now, the ships wouldn't have worked. It wouldn't have been possible to have a war on that scale. And this was something that encouraged those who were against war and also worried those in positions of authority, because the numbers of the working classes were growing and the numbers of socialists were growing. In the 1912 elections in Germany for the German parliament, the Reichstag, the socialists got the biggest share of the vote and became the biggest single party in the Reichstag. And so the Second International looked like a very potent force against war. In fact, it was not going to be so, because when the war came, the Second International fell to pieces on national lines. German socialists suddenly became very German, French socialists became very French, and so on around Europe. But this wasn't seen before 1914. And so if you looked at Europe before 1914, you could see this general sense that war wasn't necessary, it wasn't going to pay anymore, but also a more important active role by middle classes, by people who really felt that war should be stopped, and by this very large and potentially powerful Second International. So I think it's always important to remember that that was an alternative for Europe, and that many Europeans took it very, very seriously indeed. The trouble was, of course, like any society, there were people on the other side or of other views who felt differently about this. And there were, I think, very dangerous ideas afloat in Europe and very dangerous political currents. And in my view, ideas are important. How people think about themselves, how they think about what they or their society should be doing, how they see the future, these guide the sorts of assumptions that they make. And there were some, as I say, very dangerous assumptions floating around. I'll just look at a few of these, but they're really all related to each other. One of them was what I mentioned earlier, militarism. And militarism has two senses. It can mean the flooding out or the permeation of society by military values, the idea that somehow military values are what societies need, civilian societies need. And there was quite a lot of talk of this in Europe before the First World War, that young Europeans are getting soft. They don't really want to sacrifice for their countries anymore. They don't have the sense of discipline that their ancestors did. How do we instill this in them? And what is interesting is how many paramilitary groups, quasi-military groups, were being formed for young people before 1914. And these were being formed very consciously to try and give young people the right sort of discipline, self-sacrifice, obedience. And Boy Scouts. Has anyone here ever been a Boy Scout? Yeah. Well, you all know the story of how they were founded, I think. They were founded when Baden-Powell was besieged in the South African War, and he got the young boys of the town to run errands for him, and then got the idea after the war was over that this was perhaps a good thing to give these youngsters and youngsters everywhere some sort of military values. And he set up the Boy Scouts in England very consciously to try and instill the right sort of attitudes among young British men. And the Germans set up something similar, and the French had something similar. And if you look also at pictures, photographs from that time, you'll see how many school children, particularly young men, wore cadets' uniforms. The school uniform often was a military uniform. And so I think you do get a sense that military values were seen as somehow good for civilian society. The other side of militarism, and this was, I think, to be very dangerous for Europe, was the idea that the military and their supporters themselves had, that the military in some way represent the best part of the nation. They are the noblest part of the nation. They're the ones who are prepared to fight and die for the nation, which is true, and they should be admired for it, but it doesn't put them above civilian control, and it shouldn't put them above reproach. And I think it was particularly dangerous in Germany. Germany had been created as a country when Prussia, the most powerful part, the most powerful of the German states, the most powerful member of the German Confederation, had brought it into existence. And Prussia was a country which had an army. In fact, without its army, Prussia would probably not have survived because in its early days it was a very strange collection of territories, often not even touching each other. And so without the army, I think Prussia wouldn't have survived. There was a joke, which the Germans themselves used to tell, that Prussia's not a country that happens to have an army, it's an army that happens to have a country. And that gave the army in Prussia and then in Germany a very particular position. It was not subject to Parliament in any ordinary way. It couldn't be questioned by Parliament. It answered only to the ruler of Germany. It answered only to the Kaiser. And the Kaiser Wilhelm, the last German ruler, was very jealous of this, very conscious that he didn't want anyone questioning his military. And the military themselves saw themselves as being above any sort of civilian control. And what it meant was that, among other things, they made plans which they didn't bother to tell the civilians. I don't know if you know the great German plan, the Schlieffen Plan, but before the First World War, Germany had a dilemma, an enemy on either side, a potential enemy on either side. What it faced was fighting a two-front war, which no nation wants to do if it can possibly avoid. And so the German military devised this plan, which in many ways was brilliant, and I suspect absolutely improbable and unworkable. But the plan was to fight holding action against Russia with a small part of the German forces, because Russia would take much longer to move its troops up to the frontier because of the distances. While it was holding Russia, it would go very quickly into France, strike France, knock it out of the war in about 6 weeks, and then move its forces over to Russia, which would probably have called for a surrender at that point. That was the only plan they had. They didn't have a plan to fight either Russia or France. And so if they got into a conflict with either France or Russia, it was both of them. The civilian government didn't know this until 1912. And when they found out, they said, well, if that's what the military think are necessary, who are we to disagree with them? The other dangerous part of the German plan was that to get at France, Germany was going to go through Belgium. Belgium was a neutral country. Its neutrality had been guaranteed by a number of European powers, including Germany. And so what the German military were proposing to do was violate a treaty which Germany itself had signed, go through Belgium. And the consequences of that were that Britain was likely to come in to defend Belgium. Likely, not necessarily, but likely. And again, the German military didn't take that into account. They said, we don't bother us with diplomatic or political issues. We just make the military plans. And so I think this was dangerous. It was very, very dangerous thinking. And the position of the military was, in some countries, I think, really a problem. So militarism was a factor. So was nationalism. This was an age of heightened nationalism. And so much of the nationalism in the period before 1914 was ethnic nationalism. In other words, not a nationalism which says, I'm British, anyone who wants to be can be British, we think it's a pretty good country. It was an ethnic nationalism which said you can only be part of our country if you have the right family, if you speak the right language, sometimes if you have the right blood. And so you begin to get a sort of nationalism which says there is something called the German nation, only certain people can belong to it. There is something called the French nation, only certain people can belong to it. And more than that, people like me, I'm afraid, historians, create histories for these ethnic nationalisms. And so you get German historians saying, you know, actually, if you look back at the Roman times, there was always a German people, and they were always the most vigorous people in Europe. They were the only ones who could really deal with the Romans. I mean, this was very bad history, but it becomes quite powerful, especially when school children are taught it. All the histories being taught in Europe, pretty much in school before 1914, were national histories. And so little European school children learnt to be French or German or Italian, British. They didn't learn about what Europe shared in common. And what they also tended to learn was that the people on the other side of the border were different from them, probably not very nice, probably didn't have very good qualities. I mean, it even permeated mathematics. I've seen a French textbook for grade schools which said if it takes one Frenchman to defeat 10 German soldiers, how many Frenchmen would it take to defeat 20 German soldiers? You know, even in the mathematics, you get this sort of ridiculous nationalist tinge. And what you get is an assumption that we've always been good, we've always been unfairly treated sometimes, and those over there are our enemies. And unfortunately, what the Europeans also do in this period is they take in ideas from Darwin. This is known as social Darwinism. Now, Darwin's ideas apply to the evolution of species in the natural world, of plants, of animals, of fish, of insects, but they were never intended to apply to human beings, not in the way that they were applied in 19th century Europe. What you got were people saying, Just as Darwin divides up different species in nature, you can divide up the human species. And so there is a French species, and there is a German species, and there is an Italian species. And this is very, very bad science and very bad history. You can't do this. You can't identify a totally separate person called an Italian from a totally separate person called a German as if they're completely genetically different. But this is how people were thinking in the 19th century, and this feeds in to nationalism. And so what you get are ridiculous books being written by very learned people purporting to show that the French have always been a certain type of people and the Germans have always been a certain type of people. And of course, if you're a Frenchman writing about Germans, you write rather rude things. If you're a German writing about French, you write rather rude things. And so you get French, very learned French people writing about the Germans, saying the trouble with the Germans, particularly, of course, the Prussians, those who live in the north of Germany, who the French really see as the core of Germany, trouble with them is they live in a very flat landscape. Now, why is that dangerous? Because in a flat landscape, you don't have heights and you don't have depths. Therefore, you don't get a sense of good and evil. And you get the German, and these are not fringe people. These are people in respectable universities. You get, one of my favorites is a German professor who said, the French have always been a completely useless people. They've never created anything. And someone said, well, look, you do go to France and you do notice all these cathedrals and forts, and they do seem to have done some things over the centuries. And he said, yes, but he said, if you look closely at the people in France who created those things, they're really German. I mean, we find it absurd now. But nationalism is, ethnic nationalism is absurd because it assumes that people can be divided up like this in a way that they, I think, really can't. It's absolutely absurd. But this is dangerous because it feeds into fear of the others. It feeds into a sense that we have to fight to survive. And one of the other concepts that's taken over from Darwin is this whole notion of the survival of the fittest. And you begin to get people saying, a nation that isn't prepared to fight to survive has got something wrong with it, that doesn't deserve to survive. And so war becomes something in this iteration, something that is part of being a proud nationalist. You want to fight for your country. You have hereditary enemies just as there are natural predators in the natural world. So too there are natural predators in the human world. And so you actually get military attachés in Paris, German military attachés, saying, well, of course, the French have always been our hereditary enemies. What can you do? We have to fight them. And you get German, the French military attachés in Berlin, saying exactly the same thing. And so what you get, I think, in these sorts of currents is a psychological preparation for war. And there's another factor which comes in here as well, and that is a fear that Europeans are getting too soft. This is tied up with militarism. But a sense that Europe's very successes have somehow damaged Europe in some way. There's a lot of worry about modern life moving too fast. Trains are moving too fast. Undergrounds are moving too fast. Bicycles are moving too fast. And then automobiles are invented, and they're moving too fast. And doctors write things saying that if you move too fast, if you get in a car that's driving too fast, or even worse, an airplane, it will do something to your nervous system. Your nerves will get all out of kilter. A new disease is invented called neurasthenia, a disease of the nerves. And a lot of this is put down to the pace of modern living. It's also argued that living in cities isn't good for people. They don't get the sort of exercise that they give from living in the countryside. There's a lot of fear that, again, the younger generation is getting degenerate and won't actually be able to fight for its country. Let me just read you one thing from the man who was the leading German authority on military tactics, who wrote the standard manual that was used by the German army. He said, "The steadily improving standards of living tend to increase the instinct of self-preservation and to diminish the spirit of self-sacrifice." And it's quite clear he thinks this is a very bad thing. And so this curious continent, which has done so much and is so prosperous, also has these fears, these worries, these fears of people on the other side of the border, fears that somehow they're not going to be strong enough to deal with them, fears that somehow the race is degenerating. It's in this period, I was talking to someone before the lecture about eugenics, a student here who's very interested in it. It's in this period that eugenics first becomes a respectable avocation, this idea that you can breed the human race much as you'd breed a tomato or a prize racehorse. The first international eugenics congress is held in London in a very large concert hall called the Royal Albert Hall in 1912, and its patrons include Winston Churchill, the president of Harvard University, and Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone. So this is not a fringe movement. This is something that is very much part of the fears that are being felt in Europe in this period. The final piece, I think, that helps to prepare Europeans psychologically for war is what Shackleton referred to inadvertently in 1915, and that is the widespread assumption that any war to come would be a short one. People thought that a war could not last too long, partly because trade would stop, investment would stop, how would you pay for it? They simply felt it would be economically impossible because they wouldn't be able to find the wherewithal to pay for it. But there was also, I think, a sense that it would be a decisive war. All the military plans before 1914 were offensive ones. They all assumed they would go over the borders into the other country, find the other country's army, defeat it, much as Napoleon had done some of his great defeats, and of course he himself had been defeated in a similar battle. They were looking for the decisive battle, and they were thinking in offensive terms. Even though it was becoming clear that war was becoming very difficult to win easily, that it was becoming more and more difficult to attack a well-defended position, the technological edge in 1914 was very clearly to the defense. It was much easier to defend. It was not yet possible to break through strong defenses with tanks or aircraft. Those didn't yet exist and weren't capable of doing it. Yet, for all the evidence, the military kept on saying, we can deal with it. And so they came and they studied, European military came and studied the American Civil War. And they saw the hideous losses that were taken. They saw how difficult it was becoming to attack a well-defended position. They came and studied the Russo-Japanese War in 1904-1905. They studied the Balkan Wars in 1912 and 1913, all of which showed the same thing, and they discounted the evidence in front of their eyes. It's a very human failing. You explain away things you don't want to believe in. And what they said was, you know, we just need to throw more men into the attack. We've got to get them ready to take greater losses, but we can still win. And they said to their governments, the military, we can guarantee you we'll win. I think because they didn't know what else they could say. And so that's where Europe is, torn between, I think, a sense of wanting peace and those who want war. They, perhaps to gain particular goals, and perhaps to try and bring the country together to overcome the socialists who they see sometimes as dangerous. And there's another very dangerous thing by the summer of 1914, and that is Europe has come through a series of crises. It's had a series of crises from about 1908 onwards, where each time there has been talk of general war, each time it's looked like they might go over the edge now into a major war, and they have got through it. And so what they have in the summer of 1914 is a sense of complacency. When the crisis starts on the 28th of June with the assassination of the Archduke at Sarajevo, they say to themselves, it's just another crisis in the Balkans. Somehow it will be sorted out. They'll sort it out. The governments will get together. The ambassadors will get together. There'll be some sort of solution. And so people don't take the crisis seriously enough, partly because they've already gone through previous ones. And what I think is absolutely terrifying when you look back at what happened in 1914 is how quickly it went from that sense of complacency into war. 28th of June, the Archduke is assassinated. And this, of course, is where accident comes in. I firmly believe that if his driver had not taken the wrong turn in Sarajevo that day, he might have lived. And there wouldn't have been the excuse that Austria needed to move against Serbia, and all the rest that had followed wouldn't have followed. Accident, I think, does sometimes matter. But I think what is terrifying is that between the 28th of June and the 4th of August, when it became a general European war, that it's only 5 weeks. And I think that should worry us. I don't think we're ever going to explain to anyone's satisfaction completely why Europe went over the edge in those 5 weeks. I think we can see key moments, but I think we have to step back and look at this bigger struggle that was going on in Europe between those who hoped and actually worked actively for peace and those who thought, for whatever reason, that war would be some sort of solution. And in the end, in those 5 weeks, it was those who thought war would be some sort of solution who came out top, and Europe paid a terrific price for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor McMillan. Professor McMillan is willing to answer a few questions, and if you have a question, please come down to one of the microphones at the bottom of the stairs so everyone can hear your question.
I was wondering, do you believe that the treatment of Germany in 1919 was as crucial to the start of World War II as everyone seems to tell us?
I don't, in a brief answer. I think Germany felt that it hadn't been fairly treated, but then Germany felt it hadn't lost the war, and it had. You know, this was a question of perception, partly, and it was used by nationalist politicians in Germany. My own feeling is that to say that you go from 1919 straight into 1939 leaves out a lot, you know, 20 years, what were they all doing? And I have always thought, and I may be wrong, but I've always thought that there was a real hope for peace and stability in Europe if it hadn't been for the Great Depression. And the Great Depression had such an impact on the world. It wasn't just Europe. I mean, it sent Germany down the path of Nazism. Even then, and this is where we get into individuals again, Hitler was invited into power. He never won a majority in an election. He was invited into power by an old president who was probably well past it, who may not have known what he was doing, who was advised by his son and some other right-wingers, who, like idiots, thought they could use Hitler. And, you know, it wasn't inevitable that he was going to become chancellor. But once he was chancellor, he used the powers of that position to its full extent. What the Great Depression also did was send Japan down the road of militarism, military government, and helped to, Italy was already fascist, but it fed the ambitions of Mussolini to become a second Roman emperor, or to found a second Roman empire. So I think there were other chances to build a stable Europe and a stable world order. And I think the Depression really made it almost impossible to do so. So,
anyway. You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We have heard the 2015 Ross Horning Lecture, presented annually by the Creighton Department of History in commemoration of Dr. Ross Horning, a professor of history at Creighton University from 1964 until his death in 2005. The lecture is meant to reflect the many dimensions of his life, including his love for history, the arts, and the community. This year's speaker has been Margaret McMillan, the warden of St. Anthony's College and a professor of international history at the University of Oxford. Author of several books, including Women of the Raj, The Mothers, Wives, and Daughters of the British Empire in India, The Uses and Abuses of History, and most recently, The War That Ended Peace, The Path to 1914, and a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and a Senior Fellow of Massey College, the University of Toronto, Honorary Fellow of Trinity College, the University of Toronto, and of St. Hilda's College, the University of Oxford. The topic of her lecture was World War I inevitable? This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 9th, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.